Wrapping the kids out of their coat, the way the babies haven't been born.
Welcome to Teacher Besties, a podcast for teachers. I'm Jamie.
And I'm Kelly. On this week's agenda, we will talk about an update on the Detroit public school systems. We'll also talk about a recent case in the California Supreme Court that concerns teacher tenure and unions. We will talk about why David Denby of The New Yorker is arguing that we should stop humiliating teachers, and what happens when there are more cops to counselors in large school districts.
You just got back from spring break. How was your week after vacation?
It was actually good. So I went to Hawaii, which means I was 3 hours behind California time. So this was maybe one of the first times since before having a baby that I got back to school and was just drained for like 3 days because the time change just killed me.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Yeah, so I was looking out at the kids. They were looking at me, blinking, probably feeling the same thing, but their reasoning is because many of them were sleeping until noon. My reasoning was I was getting up at 7 o'clock Hawaii time, which is very, very late for me in California.
Yeah, but worth it?
Oh, yeah, very fun. Definitely a much-needed escape for the family, and also, you know, my husband and I took a little mini vacay within the vacay. So
that sounds perfect.
Time away.
I had my spring break. I went on a nice little ladies weekend and then
Didn't you go to New Jersey?
I did New York, New Jersey, and then back to California.
Any highlights you want to share on the internet?
Not really. I accidentally found the 9/11 memorial. I was like exiting the PATH train and I came up underneath it. It's actually really pretty. If you have a chance, go see it.
I feel weird about going to things like that because there's always this weird element of like tourists that are there to see it, which feels odd, but maybe from a history perspective.
I was on the commuter train and then I got out and I hadn't been down there honestly in 6 years and I was exiting and I was walking underneath it. I'm like, wow, this is really pretty architecture. And then I got out and I'm like, why are all these people staring at it? And then I saw like the memorial wall and I was like, oh, that's where I am.
Yeah.
And there were tons of people down there, but whatever.
Yeah. Let's see. Did anything exciting happen in your class? Oh, wait, you've been off this whole week. So
yeah.
Anything teacher related that you did this week or did you give yourself a good break?
I've been grading slow and steady. So a medium good break. If I didn't have to grade, it would be 100% the best break ever. But I've been grading and that's okay. I'm powering through. Mm-hmm. And what about you this week?
The thing I'm really fired up today is that, so my department is going through doing the whole thing where you pick a textbook adoption. That's what the formal term is.
Oh.
It was leaving me, which they have not done in 30 years.
Whoa. Okay,
so just in case people want to think about how long it takes for a school district and how important it is when you think about the textbooks that you get, because they might be in your classroom for 30 years.
But isn't that illegal? Can't you have textbooks I thought textbooks can't be 8 years out of date now.
Well, how did they define out of date? Because
based on publication.
So that's it, because that is clearly not illegal for an English teacher because we do it.
All right, I'm going to look into that.
I would doubt if it was illegal in my district.
I feel like it's called Adams Law or something. I will try to look it up real fast while you're talking. So textbook adoption, continue.
So part of the conversation has been sort of this tension. There's always going to be tension around the materials. And, one element of tension is trying to get more diverse voices into our curriculum. And so we're looking at what are the supplemental materials and what is actually included in the textbook. So I today, because I'm doing completely separate of this, I'm doing a project where I have kids pick a book from a list of six or seven. And I always put one, what I call check your ass book on there, which is a book that's approved by the board that I don't need any parent signatures for. So that if the parent says they can't read any of the books on my list, they get to read that book. some kids choose that book. So I went, it's also the free book if they mm-hmm. also don't want to buy one. So I went to our book depository to see, like, you know, I needed to go get the copies of this book. I needed like 12 for my three sections, and I'm just opening up the cupboards, and I start getting curious, like, oh, what's in here? You know, there's list stacks and stacks of books. Let's see what it is in here that no one teaches. Cause the only books that really stay in there that aren't in people's classrooms are the ones that, like, basically no one in your section teaches. So okay. I'm like looking, and I start coming up with this list. So on the list, I took a picture of it. So I'm looking at the picture. On the list was Black Boy by Richard Wright, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Maya Angelou, A Lesson in Dying, the play Fences, which if you're not, are you familiar with that play?
No, it sounds vaguely familiar.
It's about an African-American baseball player before integration and his struggles. Or, excuse me, before, like, baseball integration.
Yeah, I understand. I hate books about sports. That sounds terrible.
Yeah. Amy Tan and Grapes of Wrath and this book, Kaffir Boy, which is about South African apartheid. It's an apartheid story. So on that entire list, I'm like, okay, so clearly Grapes of Wrath is not being taught because people have deemed that it is too big to teach.
Well, Black Boy... Is that the one where he accidentally kills the lady, or is that Native Son? That's mm-hmm. Native Son. I don't think I read Black Boy. I definitely read Native Son. It was a good and scary book.
Okay. Well, my point is it doesn't take a genius to look at the list and see that people are choosing across the department, choosing not to teach the diverse books that at one point someone probably argued for, got in the curriculum, and now they're collecting dust.
That makes me so sad.
Yeah, and so I looked at it, and I was like, oh, you know what? I have the power to choose these books next year, so I'm going to stop teaching things I don't like teaching because they're on the list, or I'm going to make room for some of these books because, like, I feel like as a teacher, sometimes you have to look at it and say, what can I really do? You know, like, maybe you can't always fight the big fight of getting your entire department on board to teach X, Y, and Z, but you can take a look and see what people are not teaching, and if you have access to the resources like I did, you can do it, right?
That's awesome. I agree. I like this. So which one is your top pick from that list?
Well, I feel like I could do I would teach A Lesson in Dying and maybe Black Boy in American Lit because I don't really like teaching The Crucible, so I want to do it a lot shorter next year because it's a play. You can feasibly teach
it's like a very little
hours.
Play too.
Yeah, but I'm going to try to just teach The Crucible in like a week next year instead of spending weeks and weeks on it because the kids hate it anyway. And the only reason I keep teaching it is because it's required.
Why do they hate it? I feel like it's such like an awesome time in history at how like messed up everything was and like.
Well, and part of it is like all the things that I would find interesting about it, like the gender politics of like the Puritans. And
I also like the McCarthy stuff that goes with it.
Yeah, the McCarthyism stuff. But I mean, I guess what I'm saying is they don't always appreciate it.
Okay, makes me sad. That's okay.
And then I was also thinking maybe I would put I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings into sophomore year because I have a hole that I need to fill.
That's awesome. I was watching Jeopardy when I was home with my sister, and it was one of the categories was books, and the answer was I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and she was like, I have never heard of that, and I was like, what?
Wow, that's crazy.
I know, and she's not, like, she's a very smart lady, so I was a little concerned.
I will just say that, like, I feel like if there's a... I don't know, like a lesson or like a tangible thing about this. It's like, go explore the materials, wherever the materials are, like go see what's in there because it made me really sad to kind of like stumble upon them and then realize like collectively they were all the thing we were all kind of saying that, well, not all of us, but many of us were saying needed to be injected into the curriculum. And lo and behold, there it was for me to use.
That's awesome. I would just say that like where all of the history stuff is that we don't use, at least what I put in that room were transparencies that came with the textbook. So I feel pretty good about like what's not in use for me.
Nice.
But I can't speak for other people, but transparencies don't need them anymore.
Nope. Buy transparencies.
Although like some of them are pretty cool. And like if I could figure out like, yeah, whatever. They can stay in the closet. I don't need that. Everything is online. Sticking with it.
All right. So should we update the people on Detroit Public Schools?
Yeah, go for it. What's happening?
Okay. So, I mean, this is not necessarily tied to the fact that their district is in dire need of an injection of funds, but it kind of does. So 12 Detroit principals were indicted this week for stealing a sum total of $1 million in kickback money. So basically like also a vendor of like these materials was also charged with running this like bribery scheme in which like a combination of things would happen. Like maybe a principal would order supplies and then like never distribute them, or he or she would contract with this vendor for services and then be paid off in like house repairs to house. So just like a couple, I'll give like a couple of specifics. Norman Shy, 74, is accused of paying $908,000 in kickbacks to at least 12 DPS principals. So like the most that a principal was supposedly paid off in goods and services was $324,000.
Holy crap.
He did this for 13 years. And they believe that he's scammed schools to somewhere in the tune of $2.7 million. This is all coming from the Detroit Free Press. I mean, you know, a few million dollars in the, like, conversation of the Detroit public school systems is not, like, why they're in this mess. But it every is definitely little bit. Not okay.
No, it's not okay at all. It's not like you're... Okay, like Robin Hood was not necessarily correct in like stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, but like stealing from the poor, I think is infinitely worse. But stealing is not good. Just
so like one of the examples that they gave was an administrator who basically like, you know, got their entire house redone through contractors that were paid by this vendor. So like that's how they would funnel the money to them. So it was like, I need a new roof on my house. Oh, okay. I'll hire this contract and pay them to do that for you.
That's a load of crap.
Yeah. And also, I don't know if this was because the vendor was like trying to keep track of how much they owed the administrator involved here, but they had like meticulous records apparently of what they owed and how they paid for it. So it was probably very easy for, you know, when this became suspicious for them to figure it out.
Yeah. I'm sitting here shaking my head. I don't understand how people feel good about doing that.
Yeah. So,
okay. Well, that's not
so
cool.
That's that. No. So you want more details on that? Go to the Detroit Free Press. They have like a list of all of the principals that have been indicted, how much they, allegedly received in kickbacks and, you know, how that went down, although it obviously should be said that it's still under investigation.
Yeah. All right. What I saw that I thought was interesting, there was a case that the California court ruled in 2014, Vergara v. California, which basically overturned tenure, that like after your second full year, as long as you were retained, you were no longer allowed to get tenure. So that was overturned in an appellate court this week. And people are calling it a big win for unions. Pretty interesting. I mean, you and I have talked about tenure a lot, and I've always felt like it's a very nice luxury. I appreciate tenure, but at the same time, I do feel like people should be able to be fired if they're not being effective in their positions. And obviously, I would not sure if a lot of people agree with me. Sorry if I've offended you or anyone else.
I mean, I would say I have worked... I've worked at a non-union school before and two union schools, and I can tell you that every year when I was up for review, they would tell me that things like test scores and things that we know are not solely in our control were not part of my review, and yet they were oftentimes the only or the primary thing that was discussed in my review. And then I would be asked to sign my contract, so... I will tell you that I'm also, again, I don't have tenure now because I switched schools. So I lost it, you know, like I'm in a probationary period again. And I can say that there's just sort of a fear. Like, I don't know if it's just the system that we work in, but I definitely can understand the feeling of, like, doing things that are well-intentioned. But, like, if you, like, I teach in a community that I think the parents have quite a bit of power and control and, you know, can often wield that power in a way that may feel unfair or unjust.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would feel very vulnerable if, like, I wasn't working toward a tenure position.
I hear that. The article, or the person who wrote this, I read it in the LA Times, basically suggested that maybe there should be an easier way to fire teachers that aren't effective while also maintaining the tenure system, and that people mm-hmm. who are upset that they didn't win, perhaps wanted, like, a revamp of the educational system in general rather than, like, you know, same old, keep on, keep the people who really need to be filtered out, if that makes sense.
I mean, I'm pretty pro unions, and I also think that the stresses that teachers are under, I think that, you know, this might be a nice segue into our next thing. I think that most often, I think you would agree that, like, most teachers are doing their best and doing a good job.
Correct.
And I think that, yes, maybe there needs to be a better system for retraining or refocusing teachers that are not doing a good job. But I don't know. I think on a daily basis, most teachers don't necessarily, like, walk into school like, oh, I can do whatever I want because I'm tenured. Like, I think most teachers actually feel, you know, like, sometimes a little worry over the security of their job, even though we, you know, people on the outside often think that we have jobs that are untouchable.
Yeah, let's start talking about that. So you sent this to me a while ago. It's from February of this year, and it's from
David Denby.
Yes.
Are you familiar with him?
No, but you're saying it like I should be, so I'm going to pretend I am.
Well, I mean, he writes a lot of movie reviews for he's like their film critic.
Oh, yeah, I read that at the end. Yeah. He's a film critic since 1998.
So I was surprised to see this, but I mean, I guess, you know, he works for The New Yorker, so he's probably smart in many ways.
Correct. And so I read this on the plane coming back, I really appreciated this line, which is just what we were saying. At their best, teachers are everyday gods standing at the entryway to the world. If they are fair and good, they are possibly the most morally impressive adults that their students will ever know. For a while, they are the law, they are knowledge, they are justice. I made a little big smiley face next to it.
Yeah, I like that. I feel like on my best days, like, you know, I try to be that teacher for sure. And on my worst days, I'm just a crank. But
well, I have to teach this digital literacy thing about, like, being safe on the internet to my students. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions I'm supposed to ask them is, like, who is a morally good person that, like, in your community? And every single class, someone says me. And I'm like, oh, thanks.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's funny because I think I'm good. I'm really good with the extremes. Like, freshmen and seniors, like, I don't know, I just feel like I appeal them to differently. Like, freshmen, I feel like I, you know, I'm kinder to them, I'm more understanding, and I also, like, feel like it is my job to kind of, like, shepherd them into this, like, high school morality. And then, like, I almost feel the same way with seniors, but on, like, the, like, you're going into adulthood, like,
yeah,
let me show you the way.
I feel very similar, but if I can swing it back to the union thing,
yeah.
He cites some really very interesting evidence, and I'm going to just read a quote. In the real world, highly unionized areas of the country, such as the Northeast, produce students with higher test scores than the national average in standardized tests. The Deep South, where union teachers are more scarce, produces scores that are lower. So unions alone can hardly be the problem, which is definitely true. And like all other people dealing with this problem, he cites persistent poverty, which I really appreciate the headline in Stop Humiliating Teachers. We're really doing everything in our power to be awesome.
Yeah, and I would also bring this back to, like, a conversation I often have with, like, other teacher friends. And my husband will also say this, too, is, like, there are a lot of people, a lot of the stakeholders involved in educating children are not popular ones for politicians to point fingers at. You can't run a successful campaign on stop being a bad parent. You can't run a successful campaign on, you know, hey, let's make sure that one out of five of our children aren't starving. Or, I mean, you can try, but it's not really a concern.
It'd be wonderful. I wish that we could talk about hunger.
Right. Yeah. Or, you know, how about, like, we're going to invest in early education and things like that. Unfortunately, you can run a successful political campaign on those teachers suck. And part of it is everyone's had a bad teacher, right? Everyone's had a bad teacher that they think they can blame everything on. And if you have never became a teacher, you a lot of times still have a perspective of teachers, or your perspective of teachers is often the one you had when you were in high school.
Yeah.
So if you think about that, think of how much your perspective on things has changed since you were 18. Hopefully a lot. And I don't know. I just always think people forget that, and they're quick to point fingers, and they're quick to use anecdotal logic, and they're quick to say, well, you know, if you were doing an ineffective job in the private sector, yada, yada, yada. Well, if I was given the funds of a private sector and, you know, everything else, then
yeah. Again, it's David Danby, that's his name, right? He writes that corporate thinking is inappropriate in education. There's no way to translate what happens in the private sector with what goes on in the public sector.
Right. You know, and it's not an easy problem. Like, you know, if it was, we would have fixed it. It's not, educating children is, first of all, not a one size fits all thing. And yet we continue to attempt that kind of way of doing it, is let's fix this area and, like, really focus our attention on it while all of these other things are happening as well. I also noticed that he cites that book that I'm often plugging on here, The Teacher Wars by Dana Goldstein.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Which, like, if you want to know about the history of teachers and specifically, like, how unions and how women have become, like, the majority of teachers, like, it is fascinating. And it also tells you a lot about, like, why teacher pay is historically low. And, you know, no shocker there. It's because they figured out it'd be cheaper to replace men with women and pay them less.
Yeah. And if you're a married lady who's a teacher, you don't need an income because you have a husband.
Right.
So, wonderful. It's a good read. I'm sure most of our listeners have read it because it was everywhere. But
well, and it's hard. I mean, it's definitely hard for morale. Like, if we want to retain quality teachers and people who could very well go elsewhere to do what they do, then we have to stop this culture of, like, you know, shaming, basically.
Correct. Last thing, counselors versus cops.
All right. What was this about?
Basically, in a one sentence summary, that 10 of the largest school districts in this country employ more cops than school counselors.
Wow. I think even before you dive into the specifics, it's like, what does that say? That we think that it's better to treat our students as, like, almost offenders than young people that need guidance.
True. I mean, the article says a lot of what we already know, that obviously if you have more cops, we're really pushing that school to prison pipeline even more, that treating students as juvenile offenders rather than, like, actual students and counseling just perpetuates the issues that we currently have. Mm-hmm. And in case it wasn't obvious, the top 10 biggest school districts are inner city school districts, not, like, let's go to the suburbs of, I don't know, Seattle. So we're not talking about, like, fancier places.
Yeah.
I kind of, when I was reading it, like at first I was confused about what kind of counselor they were actually talking about. And it's not like, it's not talking about a mental health counselor, but an academic counselor. So
right. Yeah.
Someone who in theory should be really approachable and kind of like guide you through what high school is all about.
Or maybe you could also look at it this way. Someone who, if you were getting in trouble, could talk to you about the benefits of positive consequences rather than negative for your actions. So
correct.
Like, are we going to come with like a, you know, we're going to suspend, we're going to expel, we're going to yada, 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 do things that are punishing type things. Or are we going to kind of get at the root of the problem and talk to the child or teenager about like why those actions lead to certain consequences and what positive things they could do instead. The
something I wish
this article are really good, I think, because they really illuminate the contrast.
Correct. Something I wish that I had seen in the article, which there weren't really statistics done, but schools that had a more robust counseling department versus those who did not have more robust counseling departments. What are like the graduation rates of each of them? Like looking at like different, demographic trends.
Mm-hmm.
But the study didn't seem to encompass that. So that was a little bit of a disappointment for me to see like what were the actual impacts? Were there really huge benefits to having more counselors, which obviously I'm in favor of, but I would just like evidence.
Oh, the other thing that I found striking was like even taking the security element out of it, like how, some states have so few counselors per student. Like in Houston, there were 1,175 students for every counselor.
Yes.
And in Hawaii, which usually does not rate well on the education scale, but Hawaii had one to every 274 students.
Yeah, that was really nice. I actually, over the past week, saw like five different ads, like trying to get like promoting teachers to come teach in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was kind of nice.
Yeah. Oh, and also the American School Counselors Association recommends one counselor for every 250, which based on these statistics doesn't look like many people are doing if Hawaii is being hailed as like, you know, one of the better at 274.
Yeah, which is just crazy. So my school, I know we have three counselors, but growing up, the school I went to, I think, no joke, there were 13 guidance counselors.
Wow.
And My graduating class was 365 people, maybe
wow.
370. Yeah.
That kind of service does not happen in California, nor I'm sure does it happen in most of the places in the U.S. because, you know, that's a place they can cut. Sadly.
It is. And I'm not sure if my school, the school I went to, mm-hmm. still has that, but I was, I didn't have time. I wanted to look that up before we started talking. And I had the same guy all 4 years of high school. He like mm-hmm. knew me well. I mean, I didn't really like him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he listens to this. I feel comfortable saying that he wasn't very nice to me. Yeah. He told me that I wouldn't get into Rutgers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He told me not to bother applying.
What? You went to NYU.
I know, but I did apply and got into Rutgers in case you're curious.
Oh, good job.
It was my safety school. Yeah.
shots fired on Rutgers.
No, it's a great school. I just, you know, I wanted to leave New Jersey. Anyway, counselors, we love them. Anything else you want to talk about from this article?
No, I mean, I think it was just kind of another like thing to shine a light on, in this conversation. And it links nicely to what we talked about a few weeks ago with the, you know, the interrogation techniques and,
oh yeah,
you know, it's kind of the theme of like, what kind of an institution do we want our schools to be? You know, like, do we want our schools nationally to be a place of community where we foster learning and also like build individuals up to be great members of our society? Or do we want to see them as like, you know, mini jails? I don't think that's what any educator gets into this for, but
no, we do not want mini jails. I mean, the article does end positively in that obviously just what you said, that the best way to actually prevent violence is to create an environment where students feel supported, not where they feel threatened constantly.
Yeah.
And counselors really do play a large role in all of that.
Yeah. Yes, go counselors. We should probably interview a counselor one of these days on this podcast.
Yeah, I don't know if my counselor bestie would be interested in that. I think she would get really nervous, but I'll ask her.
Even though she's awesome. More of an introvert, I guess, is maybe the way to put it.
Yeah, but so am I, and yet here I am talking to you.
Yeah. You're one of those odd introverts that I'm always reading about but don't believe. No, that, you know, they say like, oh, well, I can do extroverted things, but I'm really an introvert. That's you.
I just need time to recharge. Like like when I'm home visiting my family, I love talking to them so much. But like, since I like spend a lot of my day being quiet when I'm not at work, I just need to take some quiet downtime.
Quiet downtime. I got it. Yeah. Even us extroverts need that as well.
Maybe I need it more.
All right. Well, on that note, I'm going to go take some downtime, aka pick up my toddler, which is not downtime.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Yeah. Enjoy that. And, we have to tell people where they can find us because we always almost forget to do this every time.
Okay. You can find us at teacherbestiespodcast@tumblr.com. You can also email us at teacherbesties@gmail.com. Or you can find us on iTunes by searching Teacher Besties.
Yay. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Get out, make a home from rented house.